Genesis chapter 20. From there, Abraham journeyed towards the territory of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur, and he sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." Now Abimelech had not approached her, so he said, "Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister'? And she herself said, 'He is my brother.' In the integrity of my heart and in the innocence of my hands, I have done this." Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now then, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, so that he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you do not return her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours." So Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told them all these things. And the men were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you, that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done." And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you see that you did this thing?" Abraham said, "I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, 'This is the kindness you must do me. At every place to which we come, say of me, he is my brother.'" Then Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and gave them to Abraham and returned Sarah his wife to him. And Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you." To Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you, and before everyone you are vindicated." Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and also healed his wife and female slaves so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife.
Well, good evening, everyone. Very good to see you. Let me first add my welcome to Kev and Anya's. Particularly welcome to you if this is your first time here at Euston Church. We do, at this time of year, have quite a few new folks in the area who've either moved into the area for a new job or study or just passing through on summer holidays. Whoever you are, you're most welcome here tonight. To begin with, I'd like to introduce you to a very interesting historical figure called John Rabe. Anya tells me that's roughly the correct pronunciation. There is on the screen. Now, John Rabe was sometimes referred to as the Oscar Schindler of China due to his hand in the rescue of up to 250,000 Chinese civilians during the Nanking Massacre of 1937-38. Later on, back in Germany, in the aftermath of the Second World War, the British Army arrested him and eventually stripped him of his work permit, leaving Rabe and his family to become impoverished, malnourished, and very ill. And it seemed like a strange way for the British to treat a guy who had saved the lives of thousands of civilians from China, a country particularly that Britain was formerly allied with during the war. Well, the thing is that Rabe, during his time in Nanking, had been a member of the Nazi Party. The British were not too concerned about letting him fall into this state of destitution because they couldn't quite marry together this ultimate oxymoron of having saved thousands of lives and being associated with such an evil, evil organization. Now, of course, sometimes there are good reasons to be slightly suspicious of people, a prime example being if they used to be a Nazi. But the kind of prejudice that can arise from this is problematic, because it can sometimes make someone overlook something good in the person that they've been prejudging, or else make the person doing the prejudging overlook something not so good in themselves. Can Christians maybe even exhibit this kind of prejudice against people who don't yet know Jesus, assuming that they're just too far gone to ever come to him or ever do anything good or worthwhile? Do you maybe even recognize a bit of this kind of prejudice in your own heart? Well, the passage today has something to say about this in response. Now, Abraham wasn't surrounded by Nazis, but he was surrounded by a group of people who, in their own way, were adamantly devoted to being shockingly evil. And we'll see that, just like the British authorities with Rabe, Abraham's struggle to imagine any kind of good can come from the people around him would have serious consequences for those people. Which leads us on to our first point, which is, be wary of self-righteous prejudice, which leads to sin. Now, given the detestable actions of the local people in chapter 19, there was certainly grounds for being wary of the people of Gerar and their king Abimelech. But a simple, healthy cautiousness is not really what Abraham displays here, as he lies, says his sister, implying she's not his wife. He fears the locals there will kill him. Why is this such a big deal? Well, if you've been here since the start of the series in Genesis, I'm sure you'll immediately be thinking back to chapter 12, where Abraham does basically the exact same thing in the land of Egypt. And in that instance, God had just promised Abraham to make him into a great nation, which would, of course, necessitate Abraham not being killed just then. And the fact that Abraham did this in Egypt showed that he didn't really trust God to protect him, and didn't ultimately trust God's ability to, or desire to, fulfill his promises. And by the time we get to chapter 20, God's promises have had quite a bit more color and detail added to them, because the name and arrival date of the miracle baby, Isaac, has now been revealed. If it was wrong for Abraham back in chapter 12 to put Sarah's safety at risk for the sake of his own fear, then it was all the more so now in chapter 20, now that he's seen God's ability to keep him safe and fulfill his promises firsthand, not just in keeping him safe in the land of Egypt, but also back in chapter 14, for example, where God enabled him to rescue Lot against all military odds. Abraham has had plenty of evidence to show him that God won't let him die before Isaac has arrived. When Abraham is caught out, he doesn't come clean and admit his mistakes. No, but he does what we'd probably refer to today as victim blaming. I mean, just look at verse 11. I did it because I thought, there is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. He immediately tries to shift the blame to Abimelech. In verse 13, we see that he tries to incriminate Sarah, his wife, implying she was partly to blame because she went along with this lie that he made her tell. Most shockingly of all, we also see in verse 13, 10 fateful words. When God caused me to wander from my father's house, He even goes so far as to try to trace his sin back to God's responsibility. It's important also to address verse 12, where Abraham basically says, well, technically I didn't lie. Sarah is my sister. She just happens to also be my wife. Now, given the original readers had just heard the rules of sexual immorality from Leviticus, which, among other things, prohibits incest, this little detail would certainly have been a sign of Abraham's moral dubiousness here. This is, of course, most tragic because Abraham was God's chosen instrument of righteousness, and it seemed Abraham used this to adopt an unrepentant attitude that he must necessarily be in the right, and any problems that arise in his life must be due to somebody else's sin. But what about us? Can this kind of attitude seep into us as members of the church, God's chosen instrument in this day and age? Well, yes, indeed it can, and we too need to take seriously the susceptibility we have to this kind of self-righteous prejudice that can have dire consequences. Maybe this manifests itself around non-Christian work colleagues, friends or family when we're tempted to be just a little bit relaxed in a full-hearted pursuit of godly behavior. Because, I mean, compared to the kind of stuff they do, we're not that bad, right? Maybe just letting slide a few little things that most people don't even care about. A bit of overeating, taking home some things from work we know we probably shouldn't. A few lustful stares that don't go any further than stares, of course. Or perhaps you've got self-discipline in these areas down to a T, but there's an issue of exposing somebody else's wrongdoings in an unnecessarily harsh way to highlight how great you are in comparison. It's important people get the record straight on how Christians are just generally morally better, we might tell ourselves. Or it might even be in the church context, justifying to ourselves gossiping about somebody in our midweek group because they hold a political or social view that you deem to be incompatible with Christianity. Excusing yourself for lashing out at somebody because you're really busy doing some important serving, but this person, assume they're just being lazy, getting in the way, never really wanting to do anything useful themselves. Maybe it's being a bit too comfortable only interacting with a close circle of friends that you neglect somebody who nobody else seems that interested in talking to. So you assume that talking to them would just be awkward or tedious. This passage also has a particular warning to us regarding accepting responsibility and being repentant for our sins. It's very easy for me to tut-tut at Abraham's stubborn refusal to accept blame. But I need to ask myself, what will I do when I'm challenged about my wrongdoing? Am I ready to go through the admittedly very painful process of admitting I'm at fault and not try to find a scapegoat to blame instead, or even try to recall some good deeds I've done in the past that maybe cancel out the present sin? This passage certainly tells me that I need to be a lot more ready to accept that responsibility. So we've seen in this passage so far that Abraham, the father of faith, isn't doing too well. So we can surely assume that the pagan king Abimelech is going to turn out much worse in this story. Well, not so much, actually. And the surprise we may be feeling from that leads us on to our second point, which is recognize God can use an unusual suspect for his glory. After Abimelech takes Sarah away to be his wife, God enters the scene in a dream and, in his great mercy, corrects Abimelech's ignorance of Sarah's relationship status, and gives him a chance to sort out this mess before he goes beyond the point of no return by sleeping with Sarah. And the subsequent interaction between God and Abimelech in verses 5 to 7 is truly remarkable. Just look at it. Abimelech says, "In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this." And God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now then, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet," which Abimelech immediately gets on to the next day. We see in verse 8 that the very first thing Abimelech does is explain all this to his subordinates, and then in verse 16 makes the whole affair public knowledge, quite unlike Abraham, who attempted to cover up his own shameful deeds. Whilst it would certainly be within his power as the king, Abimelech refrains from dishing out any kind of real vengeance against this cheeky man who got caught red-handed but can't even give a straight apology. But instead, in verses 14 to 15, we see quite a different response. "Then Abimelech took sheep and oxen, male servants and female servants, and gave them to Abraham, and returned Sarah his wife to him. And Abimelech said, 'Behold, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you.'" Abimelech, you see, goes out of his way to materially compensate Abraham for the wrong he did in his ignorance. Unlike Abraham, who seemed just a little bit too ready to throw his wife under the bus, Abimelech makes a very public and rather extravagant gesture to make sure it's known that Sarah's honor remains uncompromised in verse 16. The ultimate irony, of course, is that Abraham accused the people of Gerar of disregarding God, but demonstrated a lack of faith himself, whilst Abimelech and his men demonstrated a much greater fear of God than Abraham had in this episode. One time, me and Aaron, who some of you will know, he's usually at the morning service, but there you go, we're doing park outreach, and we came across a couple of men on Tottenham Court Road who I'd say just a little bit scary, my opinion, and appeared to be smoking something interesting. I'll admit, I was a touch nervous about approaching them, but with Aaron's encouragement, we went over and got into quite a nice chat with one guy called Ray, which soon enough turned into a discussion of our Christian faith. After talking for a little bit with Ray, one of the other guys, Pete, came into the conversation at Ray's request. Up until then, he'd just been sitting in silence. And Pete ended up treating us to a treasure trove of brilliant biblical insight and ended up praying for us as he recited Psalm 91 from memory, which I'll admit I can't do. Ray then told us that in the middle of the harsh realities of living on the street, he and his friends had found great pastoral comfort and sustenance from Pete's God-given wisdom. Now, Pete himself was homeless, didn't have any higher education, actually battling with hard drug addiction. In many ways, he might not have been the kind of person you'd expect for God to use for his glory. And yet, God certainly did that. I wonder what you subconsciously or maybe even consciously think would limit whether somebody would fear God or be used by him. Maybe it's an inability to speak clearly, or else a tendency to speak a bit too loudly. Maybe it's social awkwardness, a certain accent or lack of good English skills. Maybe it's their sexuality, the fact that they're suffering from depression or other mental health problems or physical health problems. Maybe even poor personal hygiene, being bad at handling money, being unemployed, dare I say, even which way they voted in Brexit. I promise that'll be the last time I mention the B word. Maybe it's actually some habitual sin that they've been carrying around with them for years. And whilst we must, of course, never condone or encourage any kind of sin or self-destructive behavior and warn against them, God can and does work with people carrying any of these things. The ostracized Samaritan woman in John chapter 4, who ends up being used by God to bring many in her village to Jesus, shows us that God can and does use unusual suspects for his glory, and very fruitfully so. A mention also on how this passage applies to our evangelism. What kind of person do you prejudge to be a bit of a lost cause? Because it don't quite fit the mental image of the kind of person who becomes a Christian. Well, Abimelech, being from the same extended region as Sodom and Gomorrah, he wasn't the kind of person you'd expect to come to faith. And yet we see next week in chapter 21 how his faith comes to completion as he makes a covenant with Abraham in the presence of the one true God. Now, whilst in this instance, Abimelech does show himself to be more righteous and God-fearing than Abraham, Abraham's designation as God's chosen instrument very much still stands. Which leads us on to our final point. Be reassured that God can use us despite our unrighteousness. Now, you might have thought maybe that after this whole sorry episode, God would be giving Abraham a bit of a demotion in terms of how much he's actively used to fulfill God's promises. Well, despite Abraham's rather bad witness, God actually has a special job for him, to pray on behalf of the superiorly righteous man Abimelech, a prayer that is indeed answered, in, as we see in verses 17 to 18. Excuse me. Why does God listen to Abraham after this whole sorry affair? Is he secretly the good guy after all? Well, no, not this time. The answer is back in verse 7. For he is a prophet, so that he will pray for you, and you shall live. It is very simply because God has chosen Abraham to give him the great but undeserved honor of mediating between God and man at this time. And even in the case of Abimelech, he was only righteous because he was enabled to be, because God graciously revealed to him his wrongdoing before it was too late. Any good thing that somebody does is, of course, only possible because God graciously allows it to happen. It's never because an individual is particularly righteous in themselves or deserves the honor of being used by God. This was the case both for Abraham and Abimelech, also for Pete the Preacher Man I mentioned earlier, but also for Charles Spurgeon, John Piper, St. Patrick, whoever your quote-unquote hero of the faith is. And this should be a great encouragement and comfort to us as imperfect Christians, prone to self-righteous prejudice. I'm sure we all know the feeling. Maybe you said something gossipy about a relative who's a bit challenging to be around, but your non-Christian uncle has said something really loving about them. Maybe you're on a night out with friends and you've gotten a bit drunk and acted like a fool whilst your Muslim friend has spent the night getting people home safely, completely sober themselves. Maybe you've lost your temper and gotten aggressive in a discussion about the resurrection of Jesus whilst your militant atheist friend has remained calm and respectful. Whatever the specific situation for you, your hypocrisy has been shown up and you failed to uphold the higher standards of moral righteousness that Christians are called to. Surely those evangelistic opportunities that you've been seeing grow over so long been dashed in a moment, right? Well, no. Fortunately, God is too powerful to be stopped by even our best attempts at ruining his plans with bad witnesses. Of course, we may need to pause and repair any damage that's been done by them, but if God wants to use you to work in somebody, and if you're a Christian here today, he does want to use you, then he will finish the job. So despair only to the point of repentance, wholeheartedly believing that God can and will still use you. As Christians, we've been called to live as Jesus lives, and by God's grace, we'll be made more and more like him each day. But we need to remember, of course, we're not quite the other side of the new creation just yet. And it's perfectly possible that those around us who don't yet know Jesus may well demonstrate greater righteousness and reverence for God than we do at times. We must humbly resist the temptation to prejudge them in this respect. Delight in the fact that God uses unusual suspects for his glory. And remember, of course, that by God's standards of righteousness, all the people of God in this room are unusual suspects. Are you ready to accept God using you nonetheless? Because he certainly can.